Via remote, this is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a massive year-end bill that includes both a $900 billion coronavirus aid package as well as a $1.4 trillion in annual government funding. The Senate must now approve the measure before midnight deadline expires to keep the U.S. government funded. Officials at the White House have said President Trump will sign the legislation. One of the main components of the coronavirus aid bill is $600 direct payments to most people. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said millions of Americans could begin seeing stimulus payments as soon as next week. A previous round of $1,200 stimulus payments was included in a much larger coronavirus relief bill back in March. President-elect Joe Biden praised the bipartisan spirit that produced the measure, which he called just the beginning. Well, U.S. President-elect Biden and his wife Jill received a COVID-19 vaccination on television Monday to convince Americans that the inoculation is safe as the country surpassed 18 million confirmed coronavirus cases. Monday also brought the arrival of a vaccine produced by Moderna to sites across the U.S. The priority for the mass vaccination campaign is frontline health workers and those in nursing homes, addressing some of the most vulnerable populations before expanding to others. President Trump, who was hospitalized with the coronavirus back in October, has not said when he intends to get the vaccination. As always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website, that is voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. South African health officials say a new variant of the COVID-19 virus is driving up the new numbers of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. Officials said Monday the variant known as 501B2 appears to be more infectious than the original virus. South African scientists are trying to determine if approved vaccines against COVID-19 will protect against the new strain, which is different from the one detected in Britain. The new surge in coronavirus cases prompted the South African government rather to impose tighter lockdown restrictions, including beach closings and limited days and hours for alcohol sales. South Africa has recorded more than 920,000 coronavirus cases and some 24,691 deaths, according to numbers posted by Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center late Monday. European Union and British negotiators remained in Brussels with talks still blocked over the right of European crews to continue fishing and proficient in Britain waters, as well as concerns over fair trade rules. Without a deal, Britain's link to the European Union's end at midnight on December 31st with a new tariff barrier that will sharpen the big shock of unraveling a half century of EU membership. A Sunday deadline set by the European Parliament expired without an agreement being found, leaving no time for lawmakers to ratify an eventual deal before January the 1st. Pakistan on Monday cautioned rival India against any military aggression, saying it could spiral into a mutual destructive final battle between the nuclear-armed South Asian neighbors. The warning by Pakistani Interior Minister Sheikh Rashid Ahmad comes a day after his government formally alleged in a letter to the United Nations that New Delhi is planning a staged cross-border attack. The Indian government has not commented on Pakistani charges that was plotting a military assault against the country. The U.S. State Department issued additional visa restrictions on Chinese officials suspected of human rights abuses. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the visa restrictions affect Chinese officials who the United States believes are responsible for or complicit in repressing religious, spiritual practitioners, members of ethnic minority groups, dissidents, human rights defenders, journalists, and others. Pompeo said families of targeted individuals could also face visa restrictions. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. James Mbate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Rwanda has deployed a protection force in Central African Republic.
This is not a Rwandan initiative. Rwanda is merely a contributor to the United Nations stabilizing mission. So Rwandan troops do not have a mandate given to them by the Rwandan government, but by the United Nations.
Kenyan doctors have joined clinical officers and nurses in a nationwide strike. Uganda's army vows to be loyal to whoever is elected the country's next president. Nigerian security forces rescue 84 more students kidnapped by gunmen in northwest Katsina state. And in Sierra Leone, an audit of COVID-19 funds uncovers massive corruption and misappropriation.
The point I want to make is that anybody that will be associated with issues highlighted in the audit report on the management of COVID-19 funds will be brought to book.
Ghana's capital businesswomen supported their northern counterparts, and a crisis in South Africa's chess program cost to the core of issues in the Rainbow Nation. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Rwanda's military says it has deployed what it calls force protection troops to the Central African Republic as tension increases ahead of that country's December 27 election. Russia has also sent several hundred troops. The Rwanda military says the deployment is in response to the targeting of Rwandan Defense Force, the RDF contingent, with the UN peacekeeping force by rebels supported by former President Francois Bozize. The opposition has called for postponement of Sunday's election. However, President Faustin Touadera on Monday called on voters to defy rebel threats and vote on Sunday. Gatete Nyiringabo is a Rwandan attorney and independent political analyst.
So Rwanda is one of the biggest contingents of the United Nations Stabilizing Mission in Central African Republic. Rwanda contributes troops to the United Nations Stabilizing Peacekeeping Mission. And Rwanda has been stationed there for several years now as a peacekeeping mission. Now, because elections are coming up, one of the candidates, former President Francois Bozize, has rebel groups that are coming in from outside of Central African Republic. And these rebel movements have been targeting Rwandan troops because Rwandan troops are known in Central African Republic to be intransigent when it comes to protecting civilians. This is based on the responsibility to protect that Rwanda believes in as a country which suffered the genocide in which the international community did not intervene. Rwanda makes it a point to protect civilians against armed militias and armed groups. So this one particular group has been targeting Rwandan peacekeeping troops, UN troops, because when Rwanda operates in Central African Republic, they operate under the Blue Helmet Chapter 5 mandate of the United Nations. And therefore, these rebel movements are not happy with such a stabilizing mission. So they've been targeting Rwandan troops. Therefore, Rwanda decided to beef up its force in Central African Republic by bringing in Rwandan special forces to go and strengthen its contingent in Central African Republic.
President Paul Kagame, did he speak to the country about the additional deployment?
Absolutely. He spoke both to the country and to the United Nations. Remember, sir, this is not a Rwandan initiative. Rwanda is merely a contributor to the United Nations stabilizing mission. So Rwandan troops do not have a mandate given to them by the Rwandan government, but by the United Nations. And for troops of the United Nations to come into a country, they have to have permission from the said country. In fact, Rwandan troops have been protecting the president's security and republican institutions. And now Rwandan troops are expected to ensure the safety of the electoral process.
Gatete Nyiringabo is a Rwandan attorney and independent political analyst. You are speaking with us from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. Kenyan doctors have joined clinical officers and nurses in a nationwide strike on Monday that is likely to make it harder for patients to get treatment. Doctors called the strike after talks with the government over pay and COVID-19 protective gear broke down. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenya's health facilities are facing a crisis after doctors joined other health workers to demand better pay, medical insurance coverage, and better protective equipment to help them combat the coronavirus pandemic. Chibanzi Mwachonda is the Secretary General of the Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union. He attended the funeral of a doctor who died of the coronavirus. Speaking to journalists in Kisii County while attending the burial service, Mwachonda said the government is yet to accept their demands.
The doctors across the country today can no longer wait. We will not engage in hazardous and dangerous work environments. We will not engage without assurance of our treatment, assurance of compensation to the young families that most doctors have, and assurance of employment. There's no point in training doctors and not employing them. So today begins a nationwide strike notice by KMPDU. We remain available. And after this, we hope that we will engage come tomorrow to find resolutions to this matter.
The doctor was the 13th union member to die of the coronavirus, according to officials. The strike was supposed to start 2 weeks ago, but the union postponed the planned work stoppage after the intervention of the Parliamentary Health Committee, which urged more time for dialogue. The Doctors and Dentists Union joins clinical officers and nurses who began to strike 2 weeks ago. The Health Ministry has threatened to fire medical workers if the strike continues. Wycliffe Oparanya is Kakamega County Governor and Council of County Governors Chairperson. He says it is unfair for doctors to go on strike during the pandemic and that appropriate action will be taken against striking medics.
If they have decided to go on strike, also let us also take stern action against them. We shall remove them from the payroll. I have directed that we carry out recruitment of other nurses.
Mwachonda says the only way they will go back to work is if their demands are met.
No amount of intimidation, no amount of threats will make doctors go back to work. And I will say it very clearly and again. Court orders will not stop this strike. Court orders will not make doctors stop from dying. Court orders will not stop infections or reduce infections amongst the doctors. It is our lives, and we have been pushed to the wall. We gave 21 days. We extended for a further 14 days. So a total of 35 days. Decisions now have to be made on these matters.
The Clinical Officers Union has been engaged in talks with government officials to find ways to end the strike. The union chairman, Peterson Washira, says it is not safe for them to return to work. In 2017, a doctor's strike lasted 400 days before an agreement was reached to end the work stoppage. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Ugandan army says it is ready to work with whoever is elected president in the coming 2021 elections. Brigadier Fabia Biakwaso, Uganda People's Defense Forces spokesperson, says the army will be nonpartisan and will help in maintaining peace and security in the country. Mugumi Davis Rakaringi reports from Kampala.
Brigadier Fabia Biakwaso, the UPDF spokesperson, told journalists this Monday that the National Army is ready to serve whoever is voted as Uganda's president in the coming elections.
We do not have any power to hand over. It is the Ugandans and it is their choice and it's their mandate to choose the people they want, and UPDF will be there to guard whoever comes.
In recent days, some senior army officials have been on record saying the army, in two quotes, cannot simply let those with no clear ideologies to take over power. Notably to a civilian leader that does not have a history of the liberation struggle that ushered in the current government. Brigadier Biakwaso says those are personal opinions.
Those sometimes, I think these are just sentences out of maybe unnecessary excitement, I would say. Yes.
Researcher and politician Mukalas Deus Dimobiru says such statements by senior officers are deliberate and cannot be taken lightly. Mobiru is also a member of the National Unity Platform, an opposition party, says his party is ready to defend their vote once elected into office.
The opinion of the generals is the opinion of the APDF. However, us in the opposition are not really trying to play to any officialdom. Our strength is in the people of Uganda, is in the constitution of Uganda, and we know very well that when Mr. Museveni loses this election, he'll have no option but to hand over power to the Ugandans because he has no way out.
Wycliffe Bakandonda, a senior member of another opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, says those officers should in fact be brought to book.
Ugandans deserve freedom. We are a sovereign country, we are sovereign people. And so whatever they are saying, I had one officer from, I think, Masaka saying that, and if it were another regime, he should actually have been court-martialed.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni came to power after waging a 5-year guerrilla war and has been in power for 34 years. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, December 22nd. Nigeria security have rescued 84 more students kidnapped by gunmen in northwest Katsina State. The kidnapping and rescue came just days after gunmen released more than 300 schoolboys from a week in captivity and underscores serious concerns about security in the region. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The Islamiyah school students, mostly girls, were ambushed in the Danduma local government area of northwestern Katsina State Saturday during a school procession to celebrate the birthday of the Prophet Muhammad. The military said it rescued all the students, including four others held by the bandits on Sunday, and recovered 12 cows. But the attack comes in the wake of the brazen recent kidnapping and release of more than 300 students in the state, which drew global condemnation. Eze Onyekpere, founder of non-profit Center for Social Justice, says attacks are a sign of growing insecurity in Nigeria.
It is clear from what is happening that the security architecture has virtually collapsed. And by the international ratings, I think Nigeria is the third most dangerous place on the planet to live in. We've had a situation where kidnappings, banditry, terrorism activities are the order of the day.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari continues to assure citizens of his promise to end insecurity. Last Friday, he met with hundreds of schoolboys recently freed by bandits and encouraged them to see beyond what they had been through. But while many praise his cabinet for the quick rescue and release of the abductees, security experts and owner of online security magazine, Senator Irebu, says the government needs to change tactics.
We're having a false sense of security when you have military deployed, and that's why anytime there's unrest, you easily deploy military. You are killing our security. You are removing the attention that should be paid to strengthen those are internal security operators. Military have to play a supportive role when it comes to internal security.
This month, Nigerian lawmakers urged President Buhari to dismiss security chiefs over insecurity in the country. Onyebere agrees and says the president has been slow to act.
We reached a situation where it is clear for everyone to see that the leadership of the security agencies are not up to speed. They don't have the qualities and then the competence and the capacity to tackle this level of insurgency. A government that cannot protect lives and property. It's not what that appellation of being called a government.
The Nigerian military in 2016 declared it had significantly degraded the militant group Boko Haram, predominantly operating in the northeast. But experts say the group is growing its network and expanding its collaborations with bandit groups in the northwest. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
In Sierra Leone, an audit of COVID-19 funds by the Auditor General's office has uncovered widespread corruption, misappropriation, and fraud of billions of leons. The audit covered funds managed by the country's National COVID-19 Emergency Response Center and other government ministries and agencies. Patrick Sunday is Director of Communication and Outreach of the Sierra Leone Anti-Corruption Commission.
The commission welcomes these reports and is of the view that the reports are very, very important, and the commission believes it should treat audit reports very seriously. And that is exactly what we have been doing in the recent past, especially when it had to do with the 2015 audit on the Ebola funds and also the special technical audit and the annual audit of 2018. The ACC have made quite huge gains by way of its interventions into those audit reports. And we have been able to charge people to court, secure recoveries of huge amounts of money, and also exonerated institutions and persons.
The Sierra Leone Ministry of Health is a major component of this National COVID-19 Emergency Response Center. Does the commission intend to bring charges against some people?
Yes, I would say the commission will have to investigate. And as you have said, yes, it will involve officials of the Ministry of Health and Sanitation, but also there are other sectors or agencies. We even understand that people working for NACOVA may not have been staff officials of the ministry. But the point I want to make is that everybody or anybody that would be associated with issues highlighted in the audit report on the management of COVID-19 funds will be brought to book.
This report covers something that happened during the administration, the current administration, President Julius Maada Bio. The opposition All People's Congress Party, the APC, has been complaining about corruption investigation against former President Ernest Bai Koroma. What does this report say about corruption in general in Sierra Leone society?
Well, basically, what we should understand from this report is that we still need to address the problem of corruption in Sierra Leone. However, efforts are being made by the ACC and its partner institutions within the accountability space to see how ministries, departments, agencies, and public sector institutions would improve or enhance practices that would promote transparency, integrity, and accountability. And the work of the ACC in regard to these efforts has been acknowledged both nationally and internationally. What I believe is that we do not micromanage institutions. The ACC has a duty to perform, and it's performing that duty, just as how Audit Service Sierra Leone is doing. And I must emphasize that we are collaborating in all what we are doing to see that issues of transparency and accountability are given the prominence needed to promote our democracy.
Patrick Sandy is Director of Communication and Outreach of the Sierra Leone Anti-Corruption Commission. He was speaking with us from the capital, Freetown. Northern Ghana is underdeveloped, and women have borne the brunt of it, with high levels of poverty and few economic opportunities. Business women in the capital are trying to help by working with Northerners to make unique products to sell locally and to international markets. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
In Accra, some women-owned businesses are working with non-profits and women about 700 kilometres north, sourcing raw materials for their goods, such as shea butter. The butter, extracted from the nut of the African shea tree, is a staple in Violet Amorbeng's line of natural beauty products. She says one of the goals of her business, Skin Gourmet, is to help women keep the next generation out of poverty through economic empowerment.
So we ensure that they're able to use the profits or the money they get from our purchases to improve their livelihood by doing things like building clinics, taking their children to school, and ensuring that they have a job.
Mobarika Awudu supports women in the north by buying handmade fabrics from local women to make bags for markets in Accra. Her father came from a northern village, so she is aware of the hardships in the region. She says women's economic independence has become especially important this year as incomes were stretched from COVID-19.
Some of them are doing well. They have started with weaving alone. Now they have apprentices that they are training as well. Especially now that the schools are locked down, most of the girls are now learning how to make a livelihood from weaving.
Threaded Tribes puts a modern twist on traditional fashion to encourage young people to appreciate African fabrics. Awal Rama Mankata sources her fabrics from across Africa, including from woman weavers in Ghana's north.
The fact that they are women makes me happy. There are barely any men weavers, to be honest, because they be in the farms, and even the women be in the farms too, but the weaving is a women business, and being a woman and a black woman at that, it's amazing. It's so amazing to be able to do this with women, to be honest. It's great.
While the north produces quality materials enjoyed across the world, there are few economic opportunities there, forcing young people to move south, many to already crowded cities. Much more needs to be done to help young women build their futures in the north, including investments and improved education, business and livelihood conditions, entrepreneurship expert Sheena Lovia Boateng says.
In terms of development, when you look at all the different regions in Ghana, some of the most deprived can be found in the north. So it's only fair that given that they are giving us so much value, at least we give back a bit to ensure that the community also thrives.
More investment and commitment to sustainable business practices would come with improved economic development in the north, leading to better outcomes for all, she said. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
A crisis in the world of Southern African competitive chess has demanded the attention of the nation's parliament and Olympic Committee. Parliament says dueling factions in the nation's chess federation are preventing eager players from taking part in major events, and in doing so, holding back the trajectory of an African chess powerhouse, South Africa. As VOA's Anita Powell found out in this report from Johannesburg, the issues in the report cut to the very core of South Africa's struggle to build a fair society.
Chess is taught as a game of skill and elegance, played out on a board where both sides are equal. In South Africa, one of the world's most unequal societies, the business of chess is not that simple. For 3 years, the National Federation has been embroiled in expensive lawsuits that have thrown the sport into confusion and, Parliament argues, kept deserving players from representing the nation in major tournaments. As a result, the government has suspended critical chess funding of about $120,000 per year until the impasse is broken. Chess South Africa ranks 12-year-old Lulu Miaka at 52nd nationally in her age group. And while she doesn't know what's going on behind the scenes in the organization, she sees the effects every weekend when she goes to a tournament or plays online. She sees only well-off players like herself.
I would really like for them probably to make it cheaper so that the less fortunate kids can also play. But for me, I do play a lot, but I don't see the less fortunate kids a lot because they made it very expensive just to join a tournament, which they can't go into.
That continuing inequality and how to address it seems to be the crux of the problem in the Rainbow Nation. The National Federation has two dueling boards with two very different visions, both claiming to lead, and spending tens of thousands of dollars in court to try to get control. The two sides were called to Parliament in November to account for themselves, leading them to agree to arbitration. The World Chess Federation says the game is the world's most popular sport with 605 million players, more than three times that of its closest competitor, soccer. And South Africa is the continent's powerhouse, boasting the greatest number of top-rated players in Africa. VOA wanted to fairly represent the two men who claim the top spot. So we flipped a coin to decide who got to speak first and asked, what's the problem? The first move went to Joe Mahamole, president of Chess South Africa.
Our focus should be on leveling the playing field, bring everybody on board, and remember for the children, this is also part of socialization and education. That's why it's very important. That's why transformation is actually very important. It's about building a society that believes in equality and everything done good for everyone, irrespective of your income, irrespective of where you live, irrespective of your gender, irrespective of your disability.
The government appears to side with Mahamole, but the international chess body has vowed neutrality, a situation that has left everyone pinned in place. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that's it for this Tuesday, December 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good